I'd like now to welcome John Davis. He's a wilderness explorer, he's with the Wildlands Network, and he's trekking from Mexico to Canada to let people know about the Western landscape and its wildlife. And he will be here in Santa Fe next week. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So you are traveling the wild ways of North America. First of all, what is a wild way, and why are wild ways important?
A wild way is a poetic term for a large wildlife corridor. It's an area where wildlife can move relatively freely to meet needs for food and mates and cover and shelter and so forth. And the idea of a Western wild way is to try to protect a broad swath, a mix of public and private lands through the Rocky Mountains and adjacent deserts and grasslands to give room to roam to all native species and to give outdoor recreationists like hikers and paddlers opportunities for wild pursuits.
Your work reminds me so much of the book that we talked with Mary Ellen Hannibal, the author of the book The Spine of the Continent, and it was all about wildlife corridors, and no matter how big a preservation or conservation area you have, it's no good if the animals don't have a way to migrate. So on your trek of wild ways, are you seeing migrating animals?
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned Mary Ellen's book. It's an outstanding book. I recommend it to everybody. It's Spine of the Continent by Mary Ellen Hannibal. And I am indeed, as you suggest, I'm in a sense ground truthing what and scouting what Mary Ellen wrote about in her beautiful book. And I am seeing a great deal of wildlife. I've seen elk and pronghorn, black bear, mule deer, white-tailed deer, rattlesnakes, peregrine falcons, golden eagles. I've seen a tremendous variety of wildlife. The animal I most want to see on this trek is a puma or a cougar or a mountain lion. They're all the same big cat. I've seen their tracks. In fact, one day I saw tracks, fresh tracks of a puma on top of my boot tracks from the night before. But I have never seen a puma in the flesh, and I'm very much hoping for that opportunity.
So you began in Mexico. Where exactly did you start, and how did you choose that starting point?
I started in a little village called Sahuaripa in eastern Sonora, the state of Sonora, on the southern end of the Northern Jaguar Reserve. And we chose that as a starting point partly because several of our conservation partners, and this is very much a team effort, this trek, I should emphasize, and several of our conservation partners, Naturalia, Northern Jaguar Project included, have an outstanding conservation project, a great success story underway in the state of Sonora, where they've pieced wildland philanthropists, private conservation donors, have pieced together a 50,000-acre reserve refuge for jaguars and other wildlife species. There are four native cats there. This is the northernmost healthy population, or known population at least, of jaguars. Jaguars are actually native as far north as the Grand Canyon, but unfortunately have been eliminated from most of their territory north of the border in the United States. But they're doing quite well in the Northern Jaguar Reserve in Sonora, and I was fortunate enough to see tracks of jaguar and puma and ocelot and bobcat while I was down there. So we wanted to start the trek with a private lands conservation success story and a place that's very important to wide-ranging animals like the jaguar.
So you are not taking motorized transport, is that correct?
Well, it's correct in a sense. The forward progress of the journey is muscle-powered. It's a combination of hiking, rafting, bicycling, and other muscle-powered, and horseback riding and other muscle-powered means. I actually do get in cars fairly often with colleagues to go to different areas because, again, this is a team effort involving 30 or so conservation groups involved with the Western Wildway Network and coordinated by the Wildlands Network. So many groups are involved, and sometimes the group wants me to see an area that may be, say, 50 miles east or west of where I'm trekking at the time. So I'll get in a car with colleagues and go over to that area and explore that area. So the you know, at the end of the trip, I probably will have gone 4,000 or 5,000 miles as a physical traverse under my own power. But I am taking side trips quite frequently with colleagues in cars.
So what kind of wildlife have you seen?
I've seen many, many songbirds and raptors. I've seen golden eagles. I saw a black bear cub. I've seen several rattlesnakes. Native fish. I've seen quite a few native fish, and native fish are in trouble throughout the West, so this is both encouraging and important to see in the private conservation lands in northern Sonora. I saw five or six native fish species that have been eliminated elsewhere but are being restored in this land being protected by a group called Cuenca Los Ojos, started by Valera and Josiah Austin. And I've seen many elk and pronghorn and mule and white-tailed deer. I've seen bobcats three times, gray foxes several times, coyotes. And again, I have yet to see a puma, but I've seen their tracks and hope to see one in the flesh before too long.
And are you doing a lot of, I mean, besides everything else, are you doing a lot of walking, just plain walking through the landscape quietly and observing these animals?
Yes, absolutely. Yesterday, for instance, I hiked about 20 miles in the southern Utah canyon country, and specifically in a series of canyons that go by the name Robber's Roost, and saw a rattlesnake, peregrine falcon, ravens, phoebes, actually a surprising number of flowering plants. So, yeah, I'm often hiking quietly alone. I'm also often hiking with biologists and naturalists who know the land and the wildlife better than I. I'm not an expert on any of these areas I'm traveling to. I'm a general conservationist and explorer. I have a sense of the big picture, but I don't know a whole lot of the local and regional specifics. So whenever possible, I'm being guided by biologists and naturalists who are teaching me what I'm seeing.
What are some of the things that they're teaching you?
Teaching me about the importance of big, wild, interconnected habitats, because one of the things that conservation biologists have found is that isolated reserves, like an isolated national park or national forest, unless it's connected to other protected areas, really is not sufficient in the long run. I mean, the bigger the better, but even if it's a big park, if it's isolated from other protected areas, in the long run it will tend to lose species. So you really need connections between natural areas, again, so that animals have room to roam to meet their life's needs. And so the importance of big, wild, interconnected protected areas has been emphasized again and again by biologists and naturalists I've met. The importance of providing safe crossings on roads, because our roads, well, we all use them and depend on them. They tend to be, unfortunately, deadly for wildlife. They sometimes just outright block wildlife movement, and then many animals try to cross and get killed. So there's a way of addressing that, but there are ways of addressing that problem, though. We can put tunnels under or bridges over roads and thereby save wild animal lives and human animal lives both. So I've been in the field several times with transportation planners who are implementing wildlife crossings on major roads. And these crossings pay for themselves over time in saved human lives as well as wild animal lives and in reduced collisions. So that's another point that's really been emphasized. And then also I'm learning from biologists about particular animals and plants I'm seeing along the way.
Yeah, it was looking at one of your, I think it was the Wildlands Network website, and there's the picture, just a kind of unremarkable picture of a bridge, and then you realize that the bridge doesn't have any pavement on the top of it. It's a bridge that cars can go under, and it's all just kind of like, it looks like grass or whatever that animals can go over, which is so cool. And have you seen animals crossing those bridges?
I've seen their tracks. I have not actually seen animals in the act of crossing these bridges or these tunnels. They most often do so at night. And much animal movement happens at night, and unfortunately that's when much of the roadkill happens also, is when animals are moving at night. But I've seen tracks of animals that have crossed successfully on bridges or tunnels many, many times. In Arizona, when I was on the Mogollon Rim, which is a wildlife corridor linking the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico, not too far from where you live, with the Grand Canyon Wildlands Complex in northern Arizona, Mogollon Rim is traversed by a busy road, Route 260, which has been, unfortunately, something of a killing zone for elk. So some very are seeing transportation planners and biologists work together to put in, or in some cases simply retrofit, existing underpasses, and they've been terrifically successful. They've reduced collisions with elk and motorists by more than 90%, so they've saved, again, many animal and human lives.
I would think and hope that the car insurance companies would be ponying up for those expenses of the crossings.
Yeah, it's a very good idea. I've heard that suggested several times, and I think it's a great idea. And I'm not quite sure how to do outreach to car insurance companies, but yes, they absolutely should support safe wildlife crossings, because they will greatly reduce the number of collisions between animals and cars. So that's something we need to look into.
So are you traveling, are you trekking and walking during migration periods, I guess sort of the change of seasons? And when you think about migration periods, if you're like a person as I am sitting here in the cafe, you think of these sort of highways with bears and elk going north to south or south to north. But of course, they're not going to be quite as visible as all that. But do you see migrating animals?
Yeah, in terms of migrating animals, in North America, there are not all that many huge congregations of animals that move together. There are in Africa, and it's easier to dramatize the needs for habitat connectivity where you do have these mass animal movements. In North America, most of those mass animal movements are probably birds or insects that are way up in the air and we don't necessarily see. There are places where you can watch hawks migrating south in autumn, for instance, some famous places. There are a few large animals that move in mass long distances. The Paunsagunt mule deer herd spends part of the year on Buckskin Mountain in northern Arizona and part of the year on the Paunsagunt Plateau in southern Utah, and has to cross Highway 89 to do so. And thankfully, wildlife crossings are being put in there, which should reduce the number of mule deer killed trying to cross that road. Many, many mule deer were being killed. The estimated damage per year was $440,000 due to car collisions with mule deer. So that's an example of a large herd of ungulate deer that does move seasonally, twice a year. There's a pretty well publicized migration of pronghorn antelope in Wyoming. The path of the pronghorn is the popular term for the wildlife corridor they use. So there are some examples of mass movements of large animals, but they're not as easy to see in North America as they are in Africa, for instance. But they're just as important here, and so we need to preserve the travel ways of these animals, whether they move in visible masses or if they do so more subtly as small groups.
We're talking to wilderness explorer John Davis of the Wildlands Network. In your travels, what kinds of problems do you see and witness for wildlife?
Well, the biggest single problem for wildlife in North America, arguably at least, is roads and the motor vehicles that travel them. Again, roads do block wildlife movement, and the cars on the roads directly kill animals trying to cross the roads. This is a problem that we are all part of. Almost every American drives a car or will drive a car eventually, and myself included. But it's a problem that we can effectively address, in my opinion. One thing we should do is, I don't think we should be building new roads. I think we have plenty of roads out there. And in fact, there's some roads in the backcountry that we should probably be closing because they're really not needed and they are expensive to maintain and they fragment habitat. But on the major roads, which we will continue to use, we should put in wildlife crossings, again, bridges over or tunnels under roads. So that's, I think, the single biggest problem. Another problem, though, I think, a less material but perhaps deeper seated in a sense, is that most Mexicans and Americans and Canadians want to see our natural heritage, North America's great diversity of wildlife and wildlife habitats, conserved, but not many people know how threatened our natural heritage is, how threatened our wildlife populations are. So we somehow need to raise awareness about threats to wildlife and habitats, and that's a main purpose of this journey that the Wildlands Network and the Western Wildway Network and I are undertaking is to raise awareness about wildlife and threats to it.
So you're talking, as you will be in Santa Fe and throughout New Mexico, you're just basically talking to people and bookstores and groups as you go along.
That's right, and then I have a blog on the Trek West website, which is simply trekwest.org, also available through the Wildlands Network website, which is wildlandsnetwork.org. So I have a blog. We're asking other people to contribute to the conversation by responding to my blog or submitting their own observations. And yes, slideshow. I will hope to write a book after the end of the journey. I did a journey like this in the East 2 years ago, and I have a book coming out through Island Press any week now, called Big Wild and Connected, about Trek East, again, available through Island Press. And then also out of Trek West will come a film. The great videographer Ed George is accompanying me on much of the journey in getting some very impressive footage of wild places and wildlife and recreation in wild places. So Ed George's film, his documentary, will come out sometime after the end of the trek, and that will be another way to get the word out.
So it's not exactly a pristine, solitary journey through the wild. You've got a camera crew and things like that.
Yeah, not all the time. But no, by no means is it all a solitary, pristine journey. I am solo a fair amount of the time, but more than half the time I've had biologists or naturalists or a videographer or photographer with me. And again, I enjoy the solo periods, and I tend to cover more ground during those periods, but I learn more when I'm traveling with experts. So it's very much a team effort. I'm the one person lucky enough to be trekking the whole spine of the continent, if all goes well, or much of it. Actually, not all of it, because it continues up into Alaska, and I'm only aiming for British Columbia this year. But I'm the one person fortunate enough to be trekking a large portion of it this year, but there are dozens and scores of other people involved in various capacities.
And that term, the spine of the continent, as we learned from Mary Ellen Hannibal, means basically the Rocky Mountains and that whole long corridor going from Canada to Mexico. And I mean, I'm only walking that, he said. It's a very, very long journey. The land you're crossing is a kind of a patchwork of private land and different kinds of public land. And of course, to animals, it's just land. Are you talking with the landowners along the way about what you're doing and trying to raise consciousness with them, both public and private, about this whole issue of conservation and corridors?
Yes, and more toward the middle and later parts of the journey. I've done some of that already. As I mentioned, the Northern Jaguar Project and Cuenca Los Ojos lands in Sonora and Arizona are privately owned and conserved. And I spent quite a bit of time with the people who contributed toward the protection of those lands and the owners thereof. And I've talked with some other conservation-minded private landowners along the way. I'll be doing more of this in the coming months. I expect to visit some conservation-oriented ranches, quite likely in Colorado or perhaps Wyoming and Montana, as I go north. And that is another message we're trying to convey, that any continental wildway, and ideally we'd have at least a few continental wildways spanning perhaps the Appalachian Mountains, the Rocky Mountains, the Pacific Crest, and the Boreal Forest, and preferably other places as well, like the Great Plains. Any continental wildway will necessarily involve a mix of private and public lands, and it will depend on good private land stewardship, and that in turn will depend on providing landowners with strong incentives, financial and otherwise, to do the right thing. Then one other book I would mention quickly, Mary Ellen Hannibal's book, Spine of the Continent, is outstanding. An earlier book that described the idea of continental wildways is Dave Foreman's book, Rewilding North America. Dave lives in Albuquerque, right near where you are, and he wrote really one of the most important conservation books of the century, in my opinion. Rewilding North America proposes a series of continental wildways. In part, what I'm doing with these treks is ground-truthing the ideas that Dave Foreman set out in that book, Rewilding North America, some years ago.
Now, there's a lot of parts of this that people may not realize, and I think one of the kind of paradigm shifts that is going on right now is that people are very much a part of conservation. For example, community-based agriculture is a component of wildlife conservation. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, you're absolutely right about that, Mary Charlotte. I got a good example that I was in and around Boulder, Utah for a few days earlier this month, and I had the privilege of meeting with the two women who started Hell's Backbone Cafe, which is a terrific success story. It's one of the best restaurants in the West. It's been extolled in New York Times and other high-profile publications many times. And Hell's Backbone Cafe in Boulder, Utah, employs more than 35 people. It's the largest employer in the town of Boulder. It has really helped revive the economy of Boulder, Utah. They use primarily food produced locally. They have their own little farm to grow their vegetables, and they source their beef and other meat products locally, at least as much as possible. So they've really put a lot of money into the local economy. They've supported local farmers and ranchers, and they have deliberately allied themselves with conservation efforts in the area. The owners of the restaurant are strong supporters of the relatively new Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. They say the monument has been very good for their business because the monument, you know, Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, is one of the most spectacular landscapes in North America. It draws countless tourists every year, including many from Europe and Japan. And many of these tourists end up at this nationally and even internationally known restaurant, Hell's Backbone Cafe. So this wonderful little restaurant is benefiting from the surrounding protected areas, which draw in tourists, and it is in turn supporting local farmers and ranchers and helping them be able to afford to farm and ranch in relatively gentle and benign ways. So, yeah, I think that the local foods movement goes hand in hand with the wildlands conservation movement. We should be growing more of our own food and fiber locally and regionally and not exporting so much across the ocean.
Meanwhile, if you have farmlands where there are large swaths of monocultures, as we do in many places in the United States, are those areas tough for wildlife?
Yeah, monocultures are not good for wildlife. Unfortunately, monoculture crops tend to be sprayed with herbicides and pesticides and so forth, which tends to kill insects and sometimes even birds and sometimes poisons water supplies. And there's just very little natural diversity in a big cornfield, for instance. So monocultures are not good for wildlife. And in my opinion, they're not good for people in the long run either. These crops tend to be genetically modified. Again, they use a lot of pesticides. The machinery involved basically replaces human labor with massive machines. And the money involved in those agribusiness operations is largely exported from the region, so much of it goes overseas. So and the agribusiness model of food production is not good for wildlife, it's not good for people, and in the long run, it's not good for our economy. Whereas local foods production, small-scale farming, small-scale gentle forms of ranching can support local economies and allow for hedgerows and areas of natural vegetation to which animals can move. So smaller scale forms of farming and ranching tend to be friendlier to wildlife and also better for the economy in the long run.
We're talking to explorer John Davis. So on your travels so far, have you gotten into any dangerous situations?
Funny you should ask that. I tend to be very cautious. I'm very physically active and I feel I'm capable of covering quite a bit of ground, and I sometimes put in really long days and cover a lot of miles, but I tend to be very cautious and avoid unnecessary risk. I did find myself just yesterday in some somewhat uncomfortable, perhaps even dangerous situations. I was going up South Fork of Robbers Roost Canyon in southern Utah, the proposed Greater Canyonlands National Monument, and I thought this was a hike through canyon. I thought I could just safely hike through, and to my dismay, I started to run into spillovers, basically overhangs over which water dripped, and I couldn't find any safe way up these spillovers. I managed to crawl and scramble and climb up three of them, each higher than the previous. And I was very nervous doing so because there were places where if I fell, I was probably going to break my legs. And I managed to get up them safely, but I was afraid I might meet a dead end. The canyon was sort of closing in, and then after the spillovers, I found myself in a narrow slot. And then fortuitously, there was a group of other adventurers, and it was actually some leaders in a high school class from the Colorado Academy, including three expert climbers with ropes and helmets and all that. They were coming down, and they basically said, you don't want to go any farther. It gets even more difficult and dangerous up ahead, and there's no safe way out. The last spillover, they said, was close to 100 feet high. So, thankfully, they had gear, and I retreated, basically, and went back down the canyon, and I rappelled down what I had climbed up earlier. They were a little bit aghast, I think, that I'd climbed up without ropes earlier in the day. And then I just retreated to where I had begun the hike the day before. So I got out safely, but I definitely did get myself into a situation more dangerous than I had expected.
John Davis is a wilderness explorer. He's with the Wildlands Network, and once again, he's trekking from Mexico to Canada to let people know about the Western landscape and its wildlife, and he will be in Santa Fe next week. The websites that you can go to find out more about John's journey are TrekWest, TrekWest.org, and WildlandsNetwork.org. John, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's a privilege to talk with you.